What makes an object queer? That is a question that dozens of writers from 14 countries around the globe have explored in a new book. It's called Queer Objects. I'm holding a copy, actually. It's a beautiful book, beautiful coffee table book, and it's edited by two Kiwis. Judith Collard of Otago University, who lectures in history and gender issues in art history, and Chris Brickell, who's a professor of gender studies. Chris joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Jesse. How's it going?
Good. I should have checked. Brickell or Brickell?
Brickell it is.
Great. So where did this project come from?
It actually started with a little makeup box, which a female impersonator in the Kiwi Concert Party had, which I inherited from many gay ancestors. And yeah, so the book kind of started off with makeup, really, and developed from there.
So objects are interesting enough in their own right, but you thought there might be something to the theme of queer objects.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, some things are obviously queer. I mean, if you look at a placard or a badge, you know, used in a gay parade or a protest, for instance, that's really obviously queer. But then there are other things. One of them in the book is the telephone, which on the face of it doesn't appear to be queer, but when you realise that something like the telephone, which is an everyday object, which has allowed people to create friendships and networks and set up support lines and those kind of things, actually enters into a particular, it has a queer life as well as a non-queer life. So what the book's trying to do is look at the obvious but also the not so obvious things that we might have at home that have a queer life of some kind.
And you've got quite an incredible list of things. There's a colouring book I can't talk about really on the radio, but I encourage people to look up if they're curious. Is there a particular object that you really love in the book or a couple that you could talk about?
Well, one of them that I think is really tantalising is a postcard, which also features a little bit of nudity, just a little bit, which appears to have been passed down the line from Oscar Wilde, and this is a book which is in a private collection in the UK. So the authors actually take us through all the kind of connections and possibilities about the ways in which, again, an object which is a really everyday kind of thing gets passed down through generation after generation in a sense of kind of a queer genealogy, if you like. Another sort of set of objects which we think about sometimes in terms of queer families are dogs. So there's actually a chapter about Radcliffe Hall and Una Trowbridge's dogs, which they bred, which a lot of people don't necessarily know, in the way that they kind of became part of their lives. So, you know, queer pets, those would be two kind of cool examples. There are lots of cool examples. There are 63 chapters, so something for everyone in there.
And some of them go back a bit into history as well, to a time where we might, I'm sure queer culture existed, but probably not really out in the open.
That's right. So, I mean, what we start with is a set of tomb paintings in an Egyptian tomb, and use that to sort of examine how it is that we may or may not interpret queerness in the past. What do two men on a tomb painting mean in terms of what their relationship may have been? And also, you know, some less contested early examples. So I've written a chapter on the bits of papyrus of the poems that Sappho left behind. And in terms of New Zealand examples, the oldest is the flute that belonged to Tutanekai. And my colleague Pyro Warbrick here in our Māori Studies School has looked at the friendship between Tutanekai and Tiki as part of the bigger, very famous New Zealand story, and thinking about, again, that flute passing down the time as the understandings of same-sex relationships in Māori society changed with the arrival of Christianity, for instance. So that dates from about 1600. That's our oldest New Zealand example.
And then the Statue of Liberty. Tell us, give us the sort of, I guess, the queer interpretation on the Statue of Liberty.
So the Statue of Liberty appears on the end papers in the book, and this is actually part of a series of images from a gay man's holiday in 1961. So this was a New Zealander called Keith who travelled around the world on planes and boats and took photos of his holiday. So that same set includes sailors in the UK, a gay couple walking through a garden, that kind of thing. The Statue of Liberty is his queer photo collection from his holiday in Paris. So again, anyone might take that photo, but for him, when it's curated in a collection with a lot of other objects and relationships with a queer resonance, takes on, yeah, an interestingly queer tinge itself.
And then, of course, there are the essays in the book. One of them very interestingly talks about the tendency for gay women to have their partners written out of history. There's been some famous examples of that.
Yeah, I think it's, it's interesting in a sense that people have, you know, part of this history is a somewhat hidden history because people have sometimes been written out, particularly women. Sometimes, too, we see examples of clues and hints. And one of the most interesting New Zealand examples, again, is the relationship between Frieda de Fau, who's a mountaineer. She was the first New Zealand woman to climb Mount Cook. And her partner, Muriel Cadogan, who relatively fewer people know about. So being able to unpick the kind of details of women's lives, particularly because, yeah, female couples have not had the same profile as male couples have. So we've actually made a real effort in this book to try and get the gender balance as good as we can get it. So looking at men's lives and women's lives, and a bit of a focus in some chapters on transgender lives as well.
Women's lives, including top twins who make an appearance in the book. That must have been a proud moment.
Oh, my God. The knitted doll. There are two knitted dolls of the top twins in Te Papa, and they absolutely look like them. So I could not resist, obviously, putting them in. I mean, who can resist, really?
Okay. Were people happy to contribute to the book? I imagine that people would have quite enjoyed having a go at answering that question.
Yeah, we had a really, really good response from contributors, potential contributors, not only, as you mentioned, in New Zealand, but also internationally as well. So the focus is about a third New Zealand and Australian. We've got New Zealanders like me writing about international objects. We've got women writing about men's objects and men writing about women's objects. So we managed to mix it up quite a bit. And people put a lot of passion into their writing and their photo selections. The book's really heavily illustrated. There are probably about 300 photos or something. So, yeah, there's a real kind of sense of ownership and excitement that you see as you read through the essays.
Fantastic. You've done a really great job on it. Where can people find it?
Pretty much all the independent New Zealand bookshops have it, and Whitcall's ordered some as well. So it's not going to be too hard to find. Widely available online, internationally, and on the University of Otago Press website too.
Some great old sort of erotica ads. I'm not sure where they've come from, but imagine back in the day they would have caused quite a stir. All right, we better move on. Hey, thanks very much, Chris Brickle, who is co-author of that book, Queer Objects.